On today's episode of The Good Word, Howard Beck of The Ringer joins us to discuss the Zion Williamson situation, who wants Bradley Beal, the effects of this collective bargaining agreement, and we pick our media selections for all-star starters. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Before we get into the show today, a couple of bits of business to get into. If you haven't already, please check out The Good Word with Goodwill on YouTube and make sure you leave us a rating or review wherever you are consuming this audio podcast. Today, we are joined by my friend, which is produces the greatest three-word phrase in podcast media. I feel like I can say that now because our friend is not actively doing this. So, what up, Beck? Howard Beck from The Ringer joining us here on a Monday morning. Howard is, of course, in the gentrified part of Brooklyn. How are you, Howard?
I'm fantastic, Vinny. Good to see you. Phenomenal intro. I'm not touching the gentrified part of Brooklyn part of this. The what up, Beck part is great because, yeah, our friend Zach Lowe is not currently in a position to be uttering those words. We miss him. The fans miss him. Everybody misses him. But Zach's doing well from last I heard. So we'll see him again before too long, I think.
I'm sure we will see Zach pop up very, very soon. We're going to talk about a few things today. I felt we could have went a multitude of ways. And this is almost one of those weird points of the season where, A, we're almost at the midseason point, and it feels like the season went by really fast. So we're going to talk All-Star. We're going to talk two guys who may need a change of scenery and one guy who certainly needs an attitude adjustment, at least, right? And maybe some habits that need to be changed. And that's where we're going to start. Because initially, I was going to start with Cooper Flagg. But, you know, how many people are watching college basketball right now? The last time that we had a college basketball phenom, it was Zion Williamson. And we thought, next big thing. We thought, man, when he shakes off that baby fat, he's going to be the next LeBron sort of thing, the next torchbearer, so to speak. That ain't happened. He's missed the last, 2 months? Howard's only played 7 games this season. He got suspended after his first game back for violating the team rule, which I guess was him being late to the plane. It seems like, not to be hyperbolic here, for everything that New Orleans has put into this season, when they got DeJounte Murray, they're on the lip of the luxury tax and that tax aprons, and that's a small market that cannot afford that. A lot of this was dependent upon Zion Williamson being the best version of himself. He has not been anything close. 7 games this season, hamstring injury, didn't play particularly well last night against the Boston Celtics. It feels like it's time for this relationship to end.
I feel like we've been inching toward this conclusion, the conclusion you just said, which is, you know, a breakup. I feel like we've been moving toward that almost for, I don't know, 3-4 years now. I'll just add, like, our buddy Chris Haynes reported a couple days ago that it wasn't just the plane that Zion's been late for, according to Chris, multiple practices this season. And so this was more of a habit, right? This was like teams don't suspend a player, especially a superstar player, franchise player, for one infraction. And so it stands to reason what Chris Haynes reported, which is that this has been more of a repetitive issue. And that's a concern, not just because of the actuality, the literal, oh, he's always late, Vinny. It's the fact that he's now multiple years into his career. We're on year 6 here. 1 year he didn't play. Yep. Sixth season in the NBA. And there were concerns from the get-go, from the moment he arrived, about just, responsibility, conditioning, good work habits, all these things, right? And that's fine. Guys arrive really young in this league, and some need to figure it out. But if you're 6 years in, and you're habitually late for team stuff, the bigger concern to me isn't the lateness. It's the fact that he hasn't figured it out. It's the fact that he hasn't gotten himself together and proven to be a reliable player for them, much less a reliable star for them. And we'll get into the injury part of this. Injuries are injuries, and sometimes they can be helped, and sometimes they can't. Sometimes some guys are just injury prone. Sometimes it's just bad luck. I know we have other potential factors at play in this case. But the thing you can control is your work habits and your attention to detail and being a responsible citizen, responsible teammate, responsible employee. And so I think what's most concerning to me is like, okay, yeah, he missed a bunch of games because of injury again, but you can't be on time. You can't show that you're serious about your work, about your profession. That's the part that really worries me, Vinny. And I, you know, we'll get into it, but ESPN hit the story a couple weeks ago, which has been, I think, something that like the whole league has been kind of trying to grapple with for a couple of years now already, which is how do you even value Zion? Like if you're the Pelicans, mm-hmm. how do you decide if you wanted to part ways with him, what would it even take to do that, knowing what the potential upside somewhere else is? And if you're the other place that's trying to acquire him, how much are you willing to give up knowing what the potential downside is of him just having all the same issues that he's had this whole time? So, yeah, I mean, you add it all together and he is going down the road toward being potentially one of the biggest disappointments of all time when you measure the hype and expectations and talent coming in versus yeah, what we've yeah. seen.
Howard, I don't know how to properly evaluate this because if I'm the Pelicans, A, they have to do what's best for them. Zion has changed agents recently. He's gone to Bill Duffy. And I know that sounds like it's going over everybody's head, like, oh, he's just changed agents. But usually that signifies some level of change in approach. Like you're going to get someone who's going to help guide your career, maybe wake you up a little bit, theoretically. But there's only so much someone else can do. Like you literally have to take control of your own career. Remember, the contract that he signed, the max contract that he signed, off of his rookie deal, all of these have all these have basically like pressure points of non-guarantees every single year that they do not become guaranteed until July of that next year, which means the Pelicans have to make this decision if they're going to keep him or whomever's going to have him every single summer to say, did he show us enough this past season for us to guarantee his contract next season? And usually how what that comes down to from afar, from what we see visually, is wait. Because injuries lead to the wait. Injuries lead to hamstring, foot injuries. And because Zion plays such a violent game, like we don't think of basketball as this super contact sport, but that floor is unforgiving. And if you are stomping and pounding and playing so hard with so much force and power, there's a price to be paid for that. So if you're going to do that, you have to be in the best possible shape and have the best possible approach. And if you can't show up to practice on time, like that's just part of being a professional. That's respecting your teammates. That's respecting this process that we have here. Like that is the bare minimum. I look at the Miami Heat with Jimmy Butler, when they suspended Jimmy Butler for 7 games. And I'm like, whatever it is, the Miami Heat must have a lot of film and or documentation that they're going to send to the league so that this can go through, so that they can present to the Players Association when this inevitably goes for an appeal. And maybe we'll bounce around to Jimmy Butler in that situation as we talk about Brad Beal later. But if you're Zion Williamson, this is supposed to be the year where you're saying, you know what, I'm taking everything seriously. That's the part that's a little disappointing to me, is that the lack of awareness or the lack of your body cooperating. If it's your body not cooperating, Howard, that's a bigger problem, because that means at, what, 24 years old, your body is breaking down to the point that if you are doing the right things and your body isn't responding, that it's so much atrophy the few years before that, that you're now on the downside of your career. That's one problem. But if the problem is failing to meet the moment, failing to recognize what's in front of you, you got to think, Brandon Ingram, big time contract year, he's been hurt. They signed, you know, the Trey Murphys and the Herb Joneses, and CJ McCollum is still there. DeJounte Murray get traded there from Atlanta. Like, they were putting a lot into this season, and so much was built around Zion Williamson being that guy. Howard, and maybe this is a hot take here, maybe they go the Clippers route this offseason, as opposed to trading Zion Williamson, having to match dollar for dollar. Maybe you cut bait And you don't cut bait because you don't think Zion can get it together. You cut bait because, man, maybe this relationship just isn't worth it for either side. You take the risk of saying Zion Williamson can go anywhere else in the NBA and turn it around because he gets his wake-up call or he gets whatever he wants in it. But if that's the case, you got to live with that, because what he wants, theoretically, is not you. It's not going to work with you. And I don't think, theoretically, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Howard, will we blame the Pelicans if Zion Williamson next season goes somewhere else on some type of make good deal and turns it around and becomes the megastar that we all think that he should have been? Or is the body of work that we've seen him compile with this franchise enough for us to say, oh, I get it. This franchise has to do this because they realize their relationship has gone sour through whomever's fault it is. It just isn't working anymore.
This is why it's so fascinating and so difficult. Like, I would not want to be in the position of David Griffin and his staff in the front office of the Pelicans or ownership of the Pelicans trying to figure this out, because no matter what you do, this thing can blow up in your face. It's easy for us to sit here and look at this and go, you know what? This thing's run its course. It's never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Both sides need a fresh start here. The Pelicans need to pivot, find a different direction, and Zion needs to try to get himself together somewhere else. Part ways, it sounds logical. It sounds like it's best for all parties. Fine, that's great. But if you just use the clauses in his contract to say, we're just declaring him a free agent, we owe him nothing, he owes us nothing, he's gone, and you're getting nothing in return for a guy who was the number one overall pick, who was supposed to be a perennial All-MVP or All-NBA and an MVP candidate, for a guy who could still go somewhere else and have a major influence on another team, you know, becoming successful or putting them over the top, I think it's too big of a risk. Like, it's great that they built these safety these safeguards into his contract. They're there for a reason. So yes, you absolutely have to at least have the conversation internally. Do we use these clauses and just cut them loose? Take the cap relief. Hey, we're in the second apron era. Cap relief and flexibility is sometimes better than trading for something. Sometimes it's better to get nothing in return, right? This is what the Miami Heat situation is with Jimmy Butler too, right? Yeah, we would love to trade him because he's unhappy here and we're not happy with him anyway, but we're not going to just take back crappy contracts. We would rather him walk away for nothing than be saddled with players and or contracts that we don't want. I don't know if that's the case for Zion, right? He's obviously much younger than Jimmy Butler. There's still right. some upside there for some team to acquire. Some team may think, we'll be the ones to keep him healthy. We'll be the ones to straighten him out and hold him accountable for better work habits. To your point, Vinny, about like just, you know, cutting bait, if you're the Pelicans, we wouldn't blame them. We probably wouldn't. But what if he goes somewhere else, stays healthy, plays much more responsibly, shows up in better shape and everything else? At some point, somebody's going to say, well, maybe the Pelicans didn't hold him accountable well enough. Maybe it's their fault. Hmm. Maybe. And I don't know that would be fair or true. I think the Pelicans, frankly, have done everything possible to try to get Zion to be a better teammate, employee, player. But that is one of the potential drawbacks, is that he goes somewhere else, figures it out, and now you look like the idiots for not getting the best out of him. I do think the Pelicans need a fresh start, though. Like, this part, if you were just asking a vacuum, I don't know how we get out of this, but if you just asked me, do the Pelicans need to just do something different that does not involve Zion Williamson and probably not Brandon Ingram either? Yes and yes. Like, they just, it's time. And listen, all the credit in the world, they have drafted well, they've developed well,
mm-hmm.
Herb Jones, mm-hmm. Trey Murphy, you know, they've brought in all these guys, and everybody seems, you know, the DeJounte Murray thing hasn't worked out as well, but the logic was there, though. The CJ McCollum trade at the time seemed like the right thing. Hey, let's bring in a veteran, a leader. I like a lot of what they've done. Like individually, so many of their moves have been the right thing. It just hasn't worked out. And your two biggest stars are the two guys who are supposed to be your anchors. It's kind of run its course.
Now, if there's concerns or questions, maybe you have questions about the New Orleans Pelicans training staff. Because that team seems to be ravaged by injuries every single year, no matter who.
And they've turned it over. Right? They've turned over that staff at least once or twice.
Maybe it's New Orleans, right? Maybe it's too many po' boys and stuff hanging around. Like, I don't know about you, Howard. New Orleans is one of my absolute favorite places on earth.
I would weigh 300 pounds if I lived there, yes.
Right. Despite some of the recent civic issues that they've had there around big events, there's no more fun place I'd rather be for an All-Star weekend, yes, to be perfectly honest, right? Agreed. I love it's crowded. It's a lot going on there. But I love New Orleans, right? Would I want to live there? Maybe not, right? A little different. So the question I have, if you're not going to cut him loose and you're trying to evaluate trade value for him, what type of team would say, you know what, we're the team that's going to take a chance on this player making this salary? Because Howard, and it's a greater existential question I have, I'm all for all these guys getting their money. I'm all for it. The salary cap is going to continue to rise because of the media rights contracts being done over the next 11 years with Amazon and NBC and the existing guys. But I wonder if guys will be so flooded by the money that they, at such a young age, like, will they maintain the love for the game? Like, if you're signing a $50 million annual contract at 21 years old, are you still going into the gym every damn day to grind like you were 17, 18 years old? I think human nature seeps into that a little bit. And I don't know if that's the case with Zion Williamson, because he was having these issues on his rookie deal. But I just think that's a greater question that I have for the league moving forward, when so much of these unfair questions seem to center around, do these guys make too much money too soon?
Yeah. No, you know what, Vinny? Like, this is a really, it's a really great question. It's a really important discussion. It goes way beyond Zion, obviously. You and I both mm-hmm. been both covering this league for a long time. We've seen a lot of guys come and go. We've seen great talents that just don't work out. We've seen guys who were lesser talents who have incredible careers just because they have the drive. This is my 28th year, hard to believe, 28th year covering the league. And I think one of the things I have learned in that time is that what separates, you know, superstars from stars, stars from just good or great, you know, good from bad, guys who you know, get the most out of their careers versus guys who we deem busts. I hate that word, but it's there. A lot of it just has to do with whether you actually love the game. And mm-hmm. it was interesting. A few years ago, DeMar DeRozan and Patrick Beverley, both on their individual podcasts within a couple months of each other, both hit this note of, you know what? Not everybody in this league actually loves the game. Not everybody in this league actually wants to work for it. Not everybody in this league has a passion for basketball. Some guys are here just because they've got what it takes. They've got the athleticism or the height, the skills, whatever. They got here. And certainly they put in a certain amount of work to become one of the 450 guys in this league. But they don't have the same level of commitment and passion. They just don't. And when the players themselves are saying it out loud in a way that up until then I hadn't really heard it that often, right? It tells you something. Like, these guys know. They look around. They know. They know who's here just because they love the lifestyle and the wealth and the fame and all the other fun stuff that goes with it. But do they care about winning? Do they care about being the best player they can be? It's not equal across the board. And I'm not saying in the case of Zion that he's one of the guys who's going to fall into the other category of maybe he's just here for the money, and the money is so staggering these days that it's hard for it not to change you and the way you go about your day-to-day. You're already set for life. You have generations after you who are set for life. Is Zion part of that category? I don't know. I think we have reason to be suspicious at this stage that maybe he's not quite as committed as some of the greats that we've seen. And again, that's why we say this. It's never just the talent that matters. You can jump out of the building. You can have all the physical tools and gifts in the world. But if you don't care about winning, if you don't care about getting the most out of every day in this league, yeah, then you fall into that category that we talk about for years to come of, you know what? Remember that guy? Man, I don't know what happened to him, but I thought he was going to be awesome. And we could list a whole, you know, dozens of these over the years.
Right.
I fear that that's where the Zion narrative is heading.
I think sometimes it's simple as change of scenery with guys. some guys hit mid-career points where they are like at the highest of high very early and they experience some adversity. And maybe it's the first time in their real athletic life that they've hit adversity. And it takes them a couple of years to wrap their minds around it and to understand how much it takes to put into this and what you're going to get out of this and all this other type of stuff. Like, I remember the unfortunate years with Derrick Rose had debilitating injury after debilitating injury. And then people wondering, man, is Derrick Rose, does he love this? Blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden he's played 17 years in the league. And I caution that. So I would just say, I don't think the book is written on Zion Williamson, but I do fear for the New Orleans Pelicans and their franchise. Maybe the chapter is written on Zion Williamson and his future and his present with their franchise. But when we come back, we're going to talk about another player who's making a whole lot of money but doesn't want to go anywhere. You're listening to The Good Word with Goodwill with Howard Beck. Back here on The Good Word with Goodwill with Howard Beck. Howard, speaking of teams being in uncomfortable situations, I present to you the Phoenix Suns, right? Second luxury tax apron. They clearly want Jimmy Butler. They're sending out all the smoke signals. They've benched Bradley Beal and Yusuf Nurkic. Most importantly, they've benched Bradley Beal, right? Who has not had a bad year, mind you. He hasn't had a bad year. It just doesn't look like it's the best fit with Brad Beal, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant all in the same lineup. They've added Tyus Jones. They've tried to add stuff around the fringes because they don't have the resources. When you have three max salary guys, super max type of guys, you don't have the resources in this second apron world to really go get quality guys. So now they're sending out the smoke signals that maybe, hey, Brad, if you'd like to go, you can sort of, you know, waive that no trade clause and we can see what we can find here. It doesn't seem like he wants to do that. But doesn't that make a situation uncomfortable, Howard, if you feel like the team doesn't want you? And you kind of want to stay? Like, it seems like there's this uncomfortable space that these two parties are operating in. And Brad, to his credit, seems like he's being the professional. He's taking the demotion. He played well the other night. But how do you see that situation playing out?
Not well. Like, not good. Not positive. Not, I don't know. The Suns put themselves in this position. Let's be very, very clear about this.
Yes.
The whole league thought it was crazy to go out and after they'd already gotten Kevin Durant and you had Durant and Booker, two superstars, two guys with max contracts in an NBA where things get tighter and tighter with regard to the salary cap and these apron, second apron, luxury tax, everything. Going out and getting Bradley Beal was going to hamstring them. The whole world knew it. And Beal, at the time that they got him, was on a huge contract with a no trade clause. And was deemed untradeable for the most part. And they traded for him. I'm not surprised in the least, Vinny, that here we are in January of 2025 and the Suns now may have buyer's remorse. Like, who could have guessed? We all saw this. Like, you know, not for nothing, too. Bradley Beal was not playing at an all-star level anymore because of injuries and other factors. He wasn't worth the contract. He just wasn't. He probably wasn't worth it at the moment that he signed that extension with the Wizards in the first place. And so the Suns put themselves in this spot. Like, I've got zero sympathy for them. And I don't know how you get out of this. I get that they would like to trade for Jimmy Butler. Cool. Great. The Miami Heat have no interest in trading for Bradley Beal. That's very clear. So now you need a third team. You need a team that's willing to take on Beal's contract. And then Beal has to be willing to go there. So if we're talking about like teams that still have some cap room, some wiggle room to deal with, I think the Pistons, the Nets, I don't know why either of those teams would make that move. But even if they wanted to, if Beal doesn't want to go there, he's still got the no trade clause. And then that team has to inherit the no trade clause unless he's willing to waive it permanently, which he's shown no inclination to do. I think the Suns and Beal are just stuck with each other. And maybe that's not the worst thing. Like, to be clear, like, Bradley Beal is still a very effective player, but he's not an all-star anymore and probably never will be again. That's not a knock. It's just an acknowledgement of age and miles and health and all these other things. But they're a .500 team, the Suns. with three max players, like that's not the outcome you were looking for when you mortgaged almost everything in terms of draft assets, flexibility, and players to form this pseudo big three.
Now, the funny thing is that maybe I should have looked this up. Does the amnesty clause, the stretch provision?
I think the stretch
still exists.
I think the stretch provision is still there. The amnesty hasn't been there since like the 2005 CBA, I think.
Right. You did one time thing.
That was a really effective tool. I think the small market teams didn't like that the big market teams could just eat a contract and not have to deal and not have to worry about the effects of waiving a player. This is one of those places where if the amnesty existed or if the Bradley Beal contract had some of the Zion Williamson contract features where you could just waive a guy outright, they might be better off. But no. And just for the listeners who are not aware, Bradley Beal's making $50 million right now, 53 next season. And then as a player option that he will absolutely exercise because he won't.
Yes, he will.
He's not getting it otherwise. Player option in 26-27 for $57 million. So when you're trying to come up with trades for Butler or whoever else, or any trade involving Bradley Beal, and you're trying to figure out where to send him, remember that the team acquiring him is acquiring a guy who's going to be making $53 million next year and $57 million the year after that before becoming a free agent. Like, who can afford to do that in this NBA with the restrictions that now exist in the system? Like
Howard Beck. He's making $57 million in 2 years. Now, no, think about it like this, because I want you to hold the thought. Let's say you could stretch him. Now, the stretch provision, for those who are unaware, because it has been a part of the past few CBAs, couple CBAs, it states that you can release a player, and for the length of the contract that he has, you multiply it by two, and you add a year, and the total monies will be spread out on your cap for the length of those years. So let's say after this year, they say, we're going to stretch Bradley Beal's $110 million over the course of the next 5 years. That means $22 million over the next 5 years. Like that goes from being, you're not just in salary cap hell for the next 2 years, you're in salary cap hell for the next 5 years, and you don't have the player, you don't have the trade chip, but you have slightly $30 more million to play with, or $30 more million to squander while you have Kevin Durant inching towards his, 40s and everything else, and Matt Ishbia desperately trying to put a contender together. I feel like, in a lot of ways, Howard, and maybe this is a conversation for another day, the players really screwed themselves in this most recent collective bargaining agreement. And maybe they truly didn't understand the ramifications. I said it in my last podcast. I'm going to say it here. I don't know if they truly understood the ramifications of the type of deal that they were signing that was going to be so restrictive for teams, for player movement. And even though the money is going to be there, there's less avenues for you to get your money because teams don't have the mechanisms to use it. And I feel like you're going to see it with the Bradley Beal deals, with the Jimmy Butler contract, because there's only so many places that can absorb that type of money because they can't absorb that type of money.
I have mixed feelings about this particular topic because like with every CBA, it sometimes takes a while for the system to kind of find equilibrium again. And this is a weird analogy, but it's also a little bit like 2016 when the players had decided and the Players Association had outright refused to have cap smoothing, right? This is when we were going to have this huge influx of money into the system and the cap was going to explode, which it did, which is what allowed Kevin Durant to go to the Warriors in 2016. But we also had the Allen Crabbe contract and the Evan Turner contract and I don't know how many others, like
Timofey Mozgov
contract. There were the Jan Mahinmi contract. There were all kinds of just crazy ass contracts that summer that the union on principle was saying, like, we don't want any restrictions. We're not gonna have the new money come in gradually and have cap smoothing. We're gonna let it all come in at once and just let the chips fall where they may. Well, where the chips fell was everybody maxed out a bunch of players or gave an obscene amount of money to a bunch of players who were not worth what they paid them. And then the free agent class in the next summer, 2017, got screwed by the class of 2016 because there was nothing left in the system. So this is not analogous to that, but it is in the sense that eventually what happened is the system worked itself out. Things, found equilibrium. Those contracts eventually came off the books. And what we have now in this case, Vinny, is these new restrictions with the second apron and a virtual hard cap for a ton of the league is making things very tight right now, right? We will see in the next few weeks whether we have an active trade market or not before the trade deadline. And a lot of the expectation is that it's going to be quiet because of how restrictive this system is right now. But we're just a couple of years into this deal, and all these contracts that were signed before this deal, before the CBA, are still on the books. Contracts are shorter than ever now. Give it a little time. Over the course of the next couple of years, some of what you and I would refer to and GMs would refer to as bad contracts, contracts that nobody wants to acquire and that are causing the system to get a little jammed up, they're going to come off the books, and the next version of those guys is going to have to take something. Like, it's going to ratchet down, right? Like, Zach LaVine and Brandon Ingram, as two guys who have not been able to, you know, their teams cannot have not been able to trade them because of the size of their deals, they're not signing contracts at that level again. They're just not. And the next version of Zach LaVine and Brandon Ingram, guys who might make an all-star team once or twice, put up big numbers, but you're not sure about whether or not you can really build around them, GMs are going to have to hold the line more under this new system. And so I think that will happen. Teams will start to exercise a little bit more discipline, and the system will start to loosen up a little bit. Like, I can't know any of this for sure, but my gut tells me that that's the way this will evolve.
I want to do a blind reveal. I'm sorry. I didn't put this in the initial rundown.
Twist coming.
I'm going to give you a player. I'm not going to tell you who he is. I'm going to give you his stats. And because of his stats, I'm going to ask you, should he be a marketable player to be moved? All right, you ready?
Hit me.
This player is shooting 52% from the field, 44% from three, 81% from the line. Averaging 24, 4.5 assists, nearly 5 rebounds. Is that a player that you'd be interested in, Howard Beck?
I'm not looking at it. My hands are right here. I've not touched the keyboard. That sounds like Zach LaVine. And regardless of whether it's him or somebody else, yeah, those are really good stats that I think I would like to have as part of my program. Maybe I've got a star already. Maybe I've got two stars and I just need one third guy to help put us over the top, give us a little pop when my stars are resting or something. Yes, I would absolutely like that player.
Now, hopefully the guys will put together a graphic for this. They'll put together like a shadowy figure, you know, on YouTube or something like that, and then just flesh it out, and that's Zach LaVine, right? Because that is Zach LaVine. And he's on a six-game heater. He's averaging 30 in the last six for the Bulls. And the Bulls have been more competitive than maybe people have anticipated them being. And I feel like we have reached a point with Zach LaVine, maybe not with Bradley Beal or Brandon Ingram, because we haven't seen Ingram as much. But we've reached a point, I feel like, Howard, where the narrative about a player overtakes what we see. And the contract that Zach is definitely a heavy one. He's making 43 this year, 46 next year, and 49 on a player option in 2027. That's not the Bradley Beal deal, right? That's not the Beal contract. That's not the Zion Williamson contract. But the narrative, I feel like, around a guy like Zach LaVine is like, wait a minute, this guy's contract. No, go watch him play. And I get that. I get, Howard, that the contract is a lot. But that guy can help you win. And I feel like if the Bulls are definitely intent on moving him, which it seems like they are, they don't want to take back bad contracts because they don't want to rebuild. They don't want to go through what we think they should, right? But they don't know how to get better. I feel like whoever gets Zach LaVine is going to get a really good version of him. And we're going to be looking around and saying, why didn't somebody else go get him sooner? Yeah. Like, if Denver winds up getting him, or if the Lakers, for whatever reason why, I don't know why the Lakers aren't interested in Zach LaVine. Maybe the Lakers are exercising some financial, you know, solvency or whatever it is, right? But it would seem like the Lakers would be prime to go get a player like Zach LaVine, and they're not. Denver could very well still be sniffing around him, but I feel like we're going to get to a point, I feel like we're at the point now, where we forget about the player, and we're just talking about the contract, and I think that's a disservice.
And we've had versions of this over the years too, but never more extreme, I think, than in today's NBA. This is where the NBA shoots themselves in the foot, right? They're constantly trying to create a system where they have more in this case, just more equilibrium overall, right? They want Adam Silver, ever since he became commissioner, and even going back to the CBA that came out of the lockout in 2011, when Adam was doing a lot of the negotiating on behalf of the league. It was
that was Adam's CBA. Yeah, that was not
it was,
the Stern
yeah, it was
CBA.
David's last CBA. It was Stern's last CBA, but Adam was the one kind of leading the group then. And Adam kept repeating over and over and over back then, because he spoke as much or more than David then. He kept saying, we want a league where 30 teams, if well managed, can compete for a title, blah, 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 blah. That was his thing over and over and over. And this is where we are now, right? We have extreme parity. And we can talk about why that's good for the league. Hey, small markets can compete with the bigger markets, or the non-glamour markets can compete with the glamour markets. You can't really build super teams anymore. So that means that the superstars are more evenly distributed. Everybody's got a chance. It's basically gotten to the point where Adam got what he wanted. If you're well managed, you can contend. The Oklahoma City Thunder, in one of the smallest markets on earth, have, you know, a burgeoning something. We'll see what they become, but they look incredible and they still have tons of tools to keep improving. Cool. Here's the drawback. One, super teams were kind of fun and now we don't have them and maybe we miss them. So there's that. Two, this system is now so restrictive. And this new CBA, the whole thing was basically, well, we can't let the Warriors and the Clippers. And when I say we, I mean, it's not just the league office. It's kind of all the other owners who are not the Lakers and who are not the Clippers and the Warriors. Everybody was resentful that the Clippers under Steve Ballmer and the Warriors under Joe Lacob didn't care about spending hundreds of millions in luxury tax money. They didn't care if they lost money. And the other teams would look at that and say, well, you have no penalty for continually just adding players. This CBA, because it's taken all these tools away, if you hit the second apron, even the Warriors and Clippers had to finally come to reality and say, you know what? We can't afford Klay Thompson. We can't afford Paul George. In a different CBA, Vinny, Zach LaVine might have already been traded. And maybe he'd be maybe with the Warriors. Maybe he'd be with the Lakers. The other thing is that because of the way the NBA's trade rules have always existed in various versions of this, where you have to have salary matching and there's, you know, a lot of like qualifiers on that, but it's really, really hard to match the $48 million or whatever that Zach LaVine is making in a trade, and even more so under this CBA. It's really hard to match the $50 million or whatever that Jimmy Butler is making. And so as a result, teams that would, you know, where Jimmy and Miami, they agree, we're better off without each other. It's time to move on, and they can't even figure out how to do it mechanically because the system is too tight, because the league was so intent on reigning in the Warriors and Clippers. This league was so intent on having extreme parity. And I get it. I get all of it. There is virtue to all of these goals. And the second you start to go really hard in one direction, there's always some unintended consequences. It's hard to have a system that's perfect on every level. And in this case, it's hard to have this egalitarian kind of approach and still be able to have enough flexibility for teams to add players. If the bottom line is this, here's the most simple version of this. If Zach LaVine were making 25 instead of 48, or if there were a way to trade his contract in a way that the cap hit to the new team, the acquiring team, was less. This is exactly what the league doesn't want, right? Because they don't want teams to be able to just keep piling up talent. But he'd already be traded. He would already be traded. To your point of having the blind stats, yes, every team would love to have those stats, especially every potential contender or playoff team that needs a boost, one more guy. The Warriors would have already traded for Zach LaVine, I think, or the Lakers would have already traded for him if he were making 20 to 30 million less per year. But that's not the reality we live in. And yes, contracts now override everything else because the talent isn't enough and the system doesn't allow for you to get a guy if he's making too much.
I think, unfortunately, the business has gotten in the way of the game. And I know that sounds ridiculous because business is part of everything. But we like dynasties. And by we, I don't mean just the media. I mean the fans like dynasties, even if they tell you they don't. Because they like telling you who they hate. They love telling you that they hate the Warriors. They love telling you that they hated the Miami Heat. They love telling you that they hated LeBron jumping around, leaving Miami, back to Cleveland, going to Miami, all that stuff. But guess what? The eyeballs were watching. There was a storyline that you could follow from the start of the season to the end of the season. But because Adam wants to legislate mediocrity, because Adam wants to reward mediocrity, basically, competence doesn't mean anything in today's NBA. You have to try really, really hard to be really, really bad. And I don't think with the NBA's history, and by history, I mean the boom of post-ABA merger, post-1984 playoff expansion, how are we here like eight teams win championships? Like legit, like eight teams win championships over my lifetime. I'm 40 years old. Everybody don't win. And the league was doing fine, but now you have these new age owners who feel like they deserve to make money despite their own bad decisions. Now we have problems. And I don't think this is good for the league. I understand Adam's thing, but I'll tell you this as we close out for this segment. Are you ready to spend June in Cleveland and Oklahoma City? Is that what you want to do, Howard Beck?
I'm not answering this question. This is all this. There's no good can come of answering that question. You and I will just get killed by fans in various places. Those are two amazing teams who have already played one great game and are set for another one this week, I believe.
Yes. Yes.
As a basketball matter, of course, we would love to see that. Those are not two of the easier places to get flights to, unfortunately.
No, that's the thing. You can't get there direct.
You and I make these decisions out of self-interest, and self-interest in this case is I want to go places that are easier to get to. But those are great teams. And, you know, look, this is what changing the system was partially about, was allowing teams in smaller markets like Oklahoma and Cleveland to be able to build something. And credit to the Cavaliers, too, where it's partly organic, right? They drafted Garland and Mobley. They were opportunistic and really smart about participating in the trade with the Rockets and Nets to get them Jared Allen and Caris LeVert. And then they went out and took the big swing to get Donovan Mitchell, who everybody thought was destined for New York, wanted to angle his way to a big market. And another small market came in and said, no, they basically did what Masai did in getting Kawhi all those years ago, was, I know you don't want to be here, but I think you're the missing piece. And they did that with Donovan Mitchell in Cleveland. So all credit to the Cavs. I don't know how long it'll last, because again, guess what's happening? Guess what's coming down the pike? Second apron. They're going to have issues. Eventually, they can't pay all four of those guys. That's for another day. But yeah, to your point, 2007, a young LeBron James going up against the San Antonio Spurs in the finals. An all-time player, and he wasn't an all-time player yet. He was 4 years in, but it was his first finals. A generational talent against a dynastic team with generational stars. And it was one of the lowest rated of all time. It was also a sweep, in fairness. But yeah, it doesn't always work out well for the league in terms of popularity and ratings when we have the small markets breakthrough.
Well, I'm not that much worried about the ratings. Like, I think if you produce good basketball, people will come, right? I think by and large, I think you just need to have faces and stories that people are familiar with and that they've watched grow over the course of a season or seasons, that they feel like, oh, we know Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We've seen him before. But unfortunately for the league, Oklahoma City does not participate in such things because they feel like they shouldn't. And that's the one downside of all this. And I love Sam Presti, and I love the way Oklahoma City has built its thing. But if you're going to say that this is a 30-team league where well-managed teams and everything else, and you can get your money, they don't opt out of revenue sharing, do they, Howard Beck?
Nope.
But they opt out of the storytelling. That's a story for another day. But when we come back, we're going to talk about our all-star media ballots, because our ballots are due in, I think, 7 days. Time for the last word here with Howard Beck. Howard, we in the media, we have an incredible privilege, right? Have an incredible privilege of being able to participate in the All-Star starters vote, even though I have no idea with the whole, you know, they're going to have four teams and young teams and eight guys, and I don't know how that stuff is going to be divvied up, whatever. Nobody's going to play hard. Nobody's going to try. But being an All-Star starter is an incredible honor, right? The fans have 50% of the vote. The players have 25% of the vote. The media has 25%. And we know the players are going to take their vote seriously, right? We know they're going to take it seriously.
Excuse me.
Exactly.
I think I got something in my throat or my chest. Excuse me.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine. Okay.
So on Martin Luther King Day, which is next Monday, which is also serves as another day for all of us Americans, our ballots are due. We only vote for the starters. Howard, I have my five that tentatively, right? This is as of today. This could very well be my ballot. Some of the choices were really difficult. Some of them were very obvious. But I want to go with, I want to start off with the Western Conference. Sure. Give me your Western Conference front court. Three front court, two back court for each conference. Give me your West three front court players.
Man, so a lot of difficulties this season with this, just challenges. And yes, like you, I reserve the right in the next 7 days to change some of this because it's not as clear cut as you would like it, and not as clear cut as it has been, I think, some other cycles. A couple of general parameters I try to apply to this. An All-Star Game starter, and we only vote for the starters, right? The media, we have our 25% of the vote collectively. It's just the starters. The coaches pick the reserves as they always have. A starter's got to be number one on his own team, or at worst, like a number two who's almost a co-number one. So there's that. That's kind of a rule for me. So like when we get to like the Evan Mobley, Jared Allen things, like, yeah, maybe they're going to be all-stars, but they're not starters. Like, you know, let's focus on their guards, right? I don't care what the fan vote is. We've seen two sets of returns that have come in. I'm not here to rubber stamp. You and I are not here to rubber stamp their vote. The fans sometimes vote based on popularity or who do they just think is fun to watch as opposed to who is most quote unquote deserving, where the media were supposed to be a little bit more objective about who has earned this, right? And for posterity. The bar is really high to have two starters from the same team. If you are not at Shaq and Kobe levels as teammates, I can't do two starters from the same team. So there's all that. Also, we're in a really weird moment because we have this like major generational shift happening, right? LeBron and KD and Steph are all hanging on, but we got these young guys bumping up against them. With all that preamble, the West front court, Jokic is the only absolute lock for me. And as of right now, I think my other two would be Wembanyama and LeBron.
Jokic is a lock. Victor Wembanyama, to me, is a lock because he's the most devastating defensive player in basketball right now on top of everything else that he's doing. For me, it was between KD, LeBron, and Anthony Davis. Yeah. And I went with Kevin Durant. Only because almost for the same reasons. I'm not sure LeBron versus AD, who's actually the number one on that team. Plus, LeBron took his usual sabbatical. KD has been more available, even though he's missed a little bit of time with an ankle. I feel like KD. This is where it gets even more interesting. Your West guards, Howard Beck.
Yeah. So, and by the way, Durant's missed 11 games. I can't remember how many LeBron has missed. And so the missed games thing sometimes comes into play too. So I'm still weighing that. And you're right on Wembanyama. He probably should just be a lock. But so the only lock at guard is Shea, right? That's automatic. Yes. If Luka were healthy, I think he would be a lock. But he's missed 17 games and counting, so he's pretty much out of the equation right now. There were a lot of names to consider, and in the end, I went with Steph. Steph narrowly over Anthony Edwards, and I considered Booker. I considered Ja. He's missed too many games, though. I considered Harden. Mm-hmm. I considered Jalen Williams. I considered De'Aaron Fox. As of right now, I think it's Steph narrowly over Anthony Edwards, and if you want to accuse me of a little bit of a legacy vote here for a guy who's still playing at an incredible level late in his career, maybe has slipped a notch or two, but is still awesome. And maybe it's bowing to his resume and his legacy. Fine. I'll be guilty of that.
Yeah, I'll be guilty of that too. Because for me, it came down to Ant and Steph. And with every time that Ant gets fined $100,000 or $50,000 for cursing or something like that, I do kind of chuckle. So I don't mind profanity, but considering what this game is, considering it's in San Francisco and Steph is going to be an unofficial host of the weekend, I'm going to give it to Stephen Curry. Of course, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is also a lock there. Steph is still shooting 41% from three this year. Like, that is the crazy part about Steph's numbers being down, and they are down. The raw numbers are down. He's averaging around 23, six assists. Five rebounds, shooting 45 from the field, taking more threes relative to his overall. So his field goal percentage is down because he's taking more volume of threes. That's fine, but he's still Stephen Curry. This is still a game for the fans. This is still pageantry and everything else. So Shea and Steph as my West guards. So for Howard's five and my five. The only difference is I got Durant. He has LeBron James, but the other four, Shea, Curry, Victor, Jokic. Now let's go to the Eastern Conference. I feel like there's only one debatable spot here, but I'm going to see where you sit, Howard Beck. Who is your Eastern Conference front court, your three front court?
Okay, players. So the front court started with two absolute locks. That's Giannis and Jason Tatum. Those were easy.
Yep.
Third front court spot to me came down to Karl-Anthony Towns, Evan Mobley, and Jaylen Brown. And again, I was not, and Jaylen Brown has spent like 3/4 of his time at forward. So he's a forward, not a guard these days. I don't know what the drop down, I haven't looked at the drop down menus for our official ballot yet, how the league has handled Jaylen Brown. I assume they're placing him only at forward. I'm not sure though. I went with Karl-Anthony Towns, and it's the guy's been absolutely incredible for the Knicks. The Knicks are on pace for their highest win total. If there's someone like the 53-54 win pace, that would be their highest in a long time. This was hard because I just couldn't make a compelling argument for anybody over him for that third spot. What about you?
It's the same exact thing for me. It's Giannis, it's Jason Tatum, and it's Karl Towns. And it's Towns to me because he's unlocked offensively. All the things. Now, it's hard to say. Man, he left the Timberwolves. The Timberwolves have gone down. The Knicks have turned into this uber-efficient offensive machine. It's not an endorsement of the New York Knicks as a healthy playoff outfit because I don't think none of those bodies will be healthy because Tibbs, as the butcher, will make sure that nobody parts will be spared come May, right? But Karl Towns, 55 from the field, 45 from three, 14 rebounds a game. Like I never saw a day where I thought Karl Towns, as the one interior defender, and I know he's not the strongest interior defender, but getting the ball off the glass, completing the possession, that means something. 25 and 14, that's all NBA. That's bottom of your MVP ballot type of production for a team that is still very good offensively. I have my questions about everything else on that team, which is why when I have my guards, you'll see exactly why. Howard Beck, who are your Eastern Conference guards?
So this, once again, a little difficult, and I'm immediately going to now violate one of the things I said in my opening preamble.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Because Jalen Brunson should be a starter. Jalen Brunson's numbers are only slightly down from last season in some of the scoring categories, and that's mostly because he has done a phenomenal job of empowering Karl-Anthony Towns and accommodating him, blending with him, creating that great chemistry. So I have no problem there. I think Jalen Brunson's also on a career pace for assists. Like he's been fantastic. You know, Donovan Mitchell is one of the leading vote getters along with LaMelo Ball, he said laughing, in the fan vote. But this is actually really interesting. So as of right now, I've penciled in Donovan Mitchell. But you know who might actually deserve it more than Donovan Mitchell is Darius Garland. We can get into this in a minute. I'll let you list yours first.
But as of right now,
I've got Brunson and Donovan Mitchell. And no, Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns are not Shaq and Kobe. I have immediately violated my Shaq and Kobe edict. Sue me. But I just, in part, it's because I don't find a compelling argument for some other guys over those two at their respective positions.
This is where the rubber meets the road, right?
Here we go.
Damian Lillard has a case.
He does.
Not as strong of a case. Strong case. Jalen Brunson has a strong case. Darius Garland has a case. I don't say that Trae Young has a case, but let's just put him theoretically.
Yeah, I jotted him down. Ball's, I looked at everything.
Yeah, LaMelo Ball's going to be there. And Howard, you're going to say that I am a victim of recency bias or regency bias, right? But I believe Kay Cunningham is an all-star starter this
year. This is provincialism bias, actually. This is proximity bias. This is...
I'll say region. Region.
Look at this. You know, I'm in New York, and I put in the New York guys. You're in Detroit. And the thing is, you're not a Pistons fan. I'm not a Knicks fan. I mean, there is something to be exposed, I think, sometimes to guys in our own backyards a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I do acknowledge that, we see more of it. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just funny that's the way that this broke down. And I considered Kate as well, but go.
Carrying a franchise that this time last year was 3-36.
Yeah.
And now they are above 500, where the major additions are an older Tobias Harris, Tim Hardaway Jr., and Malik Beasley. The common denominator in this has been Cade Cunningham, the number one pick a couple of years ago. He missed most of his second year. Yeah. Last year went through what he went through. And this year, 24, nearly 10 assists, nearly 7 rebounds. It's been done 16 times in NBA history, right? The guys have been averaging 24, 9, and 7. And I don't have the list in front of me, but if the names go like this, LeBron, Luka, Oscar. Yeah. It's happened 16 times in Russell Westbrook. Yeah. All those guys in those years were all-stars, granted all-star starters, whatever it was. But taking this team and turning it into a winning team, taking this team and turning it won 9 out of 11, and not just the vibes are great, but you're carrying a franchise. I think that means a lot to me. Being the guy, lifting a franchise means more than Jalen Brunson, who I really like. But his stats across the board, theoretically, his stats across the board are pretty much higher than Jalen Brunson, and he does not have a Karl Anthony Towns. And then my second guard is Donovan Mitchell, because even though his stats are down, I feel like that's a function of his minutes being down and him willingly sacrificing for the other players on that team so that he can be healthier down the stretch. We know that Donovan Mitchell is going to be the guy when it comes down to April, May, and June if they're still sticking around. So you can say, Vinny's a homer. Trust me, no, I'm not. The Lions are playing a football game this weekend, and I ain't rooting for them. I'm not that guy. I promise you. I am a child of the bad boys. That team back there. These bad boys were bad last year. But Cade, he's a bad boy, man.
He's been awesome. Bad boy. And I think he deserves recognition, and I think he will be an all-star regardless. He's probably not going to get voted in, but I have no doubt. I have very little doubt, anyway, that the coaches will put him in, and he's earned it. And it's great to see. And yeah, he's the reason that the Pistons are respectable again. JB Bickerstaff's done a great job too. And I think they've done a nice job of just kind of balancing out that roster. They're finally seemed to be on the right path. They're only a game over 500. And I know that the answer to that is, well, yeah, Cade doesn't have Karl Anthony Towns. I mean, we already know what Jalen Brunson can do with star talent, no star talent, broken talent, seventh, eighth, ninth men on the bench and two-way guys, because last year the entire team disintegrated along the way and Jalen Brunson can't. So we know that we're not overestimating Jalen Brunson just based on having a superstar teammate or an all-star teammate in Towns. It's that Jalen Brunson's just continuing what he's already done. And yeah, statistically, Cade is the better player. Effectively, or the whole quote-unquote impact on winning thing, always harder to gauge a little bit. I haven't looked at some of the advanced stats of Cade versus Brunson. I don't mind the argument for Cade over Brunson. I do think that when push comes to shove, and I think the coaches generally take it this way too, if it's close, you lean toward the guy who's contributed to more wins, right?
Yeah.
The record eventually comes into play, and we don't often, that's what hurts Trae Young, right? That's what hurts some guys who have put up big stats on losing teams.
Tyler Hero has had an excellent season so far.
So let me just get into this, because we both have Donovan Mitchell as our second guard. We differ on the other. But yep. I'm not actually positive on Donovan Mitchell over Darius Garland. This is really interesting. So let me pull this up real quick. I ran this on StatHead, which is part of Basketball Reference, which is a great tool. When you put them side by side, these teammates in the Cavaliers starting backcourt, Donovan Mitchell is scoring more, almost 23 points a game to 21, so not by a ton. Donovan Mitchell is rebounding more, 4.4 to 2.6. Darius Garland is averaging 6.7 assists to Mitchell's 4.6. Darius Garland is shooting better from three, 43%, scorching to 41%, which is still awesome. He's shooting better from the line, 91% to 81%. His effective field goal percentage, which combines twos and threes, Garland's at nearly 600 to 555 for Donovan Mitchell. A lot of the advanced stats have Garland over Mitchell. It's not obvious. Now, if you were to ask, like, who's the more important player, especially in crunch time, or who's the leader by virtue of longevity, track record, resume, like, yeah, Donovan Mitchell's the veteran, the more veteran of the two of them. And I think in a lot of ways he is defining this era of the Cavaliers, but they are an ensemble with those two guys plus Mobley and Jared Allen. And Mitchell, as you said, to his credit, has ceded a little bit, has ratcheted down a little bit to let everybody else thrive. But statistically, Garland's got a case over his teammate.
No, he does. There's a world when you look at all the guards in the Eastern Conference, right? If you consider Jaylen Brown a guard, I think he's listed as a forward, but he could be a guard. Who knows, right? With Cade Cunningham, Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, LaMelo Ball, who's going to win the fan vote because he's at such a far away margin. Even though I don't think that he's playing impactful basketball, people like him. I don't know why. Like, that's the thing I don't get, to be perfectly honest. Maybe it's because kids have watched him grow up, but it doesn't seem like he's a magnetic personality. He doesn't show much of anything, but for whatever reason, like, the fans are gravitating to him, or a large segment of voting fans are gravitating to him. I would love to see what the numbers look like if Charlotte's actually on TV and to see, you know, how that plays itself out. But with those four, plus Tyler Hero, right? Plus Damian Lillard, right? That's like seven guards. And it's only like maybe there's two guards to start, two guards off the bench, and then two more wild cards. So at max, there could be six, when there could be up to seven or eight very deserving guard spots. We didn't mention Evan Mobley, even though you mentioned it in your preamble. He might be their best player. And with Cleveland's, you know, 70-win pace record, you could make the case. Maybe they deserve three All-Stars.
Or four with Jared Allen.
See, yeah. I can't see four. I can see three.
I mean, I wouldn't normally argue for it, and I'm not sure I am arguing for it, but I'm not dismissing it, because when you're on a 70-win pace, And they are kind of a classic ensemble. Like, all those guys, they all matter. You have to at least think about it. I'm glad I'm not the coaches having to pick the seven reserves, because I think that's going to be really tough too. But by the way, you listed all the guards, and they're all worthy on some level, and you can build a case around any of them, but the distinctions between them are slim enough that you just have to kind of decide what's the most important thing. And so, like, I'm looking at, like, games missed. And I did this with Durant in the West a minute ago. Damian Lillard's missed eight games. Not a ton. It's not double digits, but he's missed eight games. Right. Tyrese Maxey's missed seven, which is why I didn't really put him in this discussion. Tyrese Halliburton is having a little bit of a down season, so I was able to kind of cut him off early on in my worksheet here. But you start to have to drill down on what you think matters most. How much are you weighing the wins? How much are you weighing games played or games missed? How much are you weighing, efficiency, team context? It gets tricky.
It's not easy. It's legit not easy. Like, as of the most recent returns, which I believe was last Monday. Last Thursday, excuse me. The order in the Eastern Conference guards went like this, in order: LaMelo Ball, Donovan Mitchell, Damian Lillard, Jalen Brunson, Trae Young, Tyrese Maxey, Kay Cunningham at 7, Jordan Poole at 8, Darius Garland at 9, and then Tyler Hero at 10. Like, it's a hard, that's a lot of other places are cut and dry. Like, think about it. If Paolo Banchero had been healthy enough throughout this entire season, if Wagner in Orlando, his teammate, had been healthy enough through this, like, in some ways, this is a little bit easier for us because guys have been hurt.
Not only that, if not for Jimmy Butler's meltdown, not only would we be considering Jimmy, but we might be considering Bam. Like, Bam's being dragged down by the Heat's poor record to an extent.
Well, I don't think Bam is having as great of a year.
Yeah, that's also true. I'm just saying, like, in general, like, guys who are who are kind of perennially in the conversation, some of them just fell out, right? Banchero and Wagner, Jimmy Butler, and that's made it.
Joel Embiid.
Paul George. Yeah, like, there were a bunch of guys. When I sat down, I'm like, oh, cool, I can cross all these guys off. Not because I don't want to consider them, but because it just becomes easier. Like, there, if you haven't played enough games, you're just not qualified, right? So it makes our jobs in voting a little bit easier. It's also very unfortunate, right? I'm not that excited to cross them out. It sucks that we don't get more games from some of the best players in the game. That's the world we live in, sadly.
Them's the breaks. It's going to be an interesting layout because I wonder what, like you said, what the coaches are going to reward. I wonder what we as a media sort of voting block is going to reward when our votes wind up going out. It's not like the postseason awards where everybody gets to see who everybody voted for. We're just going to have a voting block, and that's what it's going to be. So I'm very curious how that's going to lay out. But my man Howard Beck, I really appreciate you, man. This has been a great show. Love having you on, as always, in Brooklyn. Enjoy your view of the Brooklyn Bridge or whatever the hell you live by.
Vinny, always a pleasure, man. Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Howard Beck for joining us today. Thanks to Colin and the entire team who worked so hard behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. I'll be back with another episode of The Good Word with Goodwill on Wednesday. That's with Titus and with Ice. Until then, everybody be safe.